Hey, what's going on? Welcome to The Doug Show. My name is Doug Cunnington, and I'm excited to talk to Steve Stewart today. And it turns out he edits and works on a lot of my favorite podcasts, some of the biggest podcasts in the personal finance and really just the business space overall. So Steve, welcome to the show. Glad you can make it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Doug. It's an honor to be here. I didn't expect to ever be on your show, so this is really neat.
Very cool. So we've known each other for a couple years, and we met at a conference. And I often tell people, like, there's no better way to like build a connection. We can meet each other online and chat and even schedule meetings, but there's no way to replace like sitting next to each other and chatting, which we actually did at least a couple conferences. But for the people that don't know you, who are you? What do you do? And we're gonna talk about your podcast editing. I mean, the whole service and the, I don't know if it's an agency, but you have a lot of stuff in that area. So who are you? What's your background?
I'm a guy who fell in love with personal finance in the mid-2000s. And it took over part of my life. I was still working a day job, but I started a financial coaching business and found that I needed to start blogging. So I started blogging in 2007, but that went nowhere. But I found a love for the audio medium of podcasting. I had been a mobile DJ for 3 decades. And so I knew the gear. I knew some of the tech. I just didn't know about RSS feeds and how to get into Apple and all that fun stuff. So I stumbled through some of that and started a show in 2010. Fell in love with the medium. Then I found out about a conference called FinCon, started going to that. Bunch of content creators just like myself were there. I started to encourage other people who are only writing blogs to do something more. I was always saying, you know, get your face and your voice on your blog, because it was all just text and, you know, logos and no personality, but it was all in the writing. And through that encouragement and getting to know people by encouraging them, I eventually got asked to edit somebody's or they wanted to start a podcast, and they're like, we just want to hit record, we do the rest. I'm like, sure, I know how to do it. Never imagined in a million years that it would become a career within 6 months. And it did. In the middle of 2016, I had to drop everything I was doing. I had already left the day job. I had to give up my financial coaching business, which was just kind of stagnant. It wasn't going anywhere. So I guess it kind of shows you how good of a coach I was, or a salesman, I guess, is really the problem there. And have been editing podcasts ever since for people mostly in the personal finance genre.
Interesting. And right now, do you have employees or do you do the editing yourself?
There's 3 employees, me, myself, and I. We've been the same 3 employees since the beginning, but you know, it's an LLC type thing. But I do have contractors. These are people that I trained how to edit my way, which really helps with quality control, because it's nothing worse than, you know, oh, Joe Bob, you know, he's a friend of a friend. He could edit too. Send him the product and it comes back and it's not the same. So I've got four or five, some go on seasonal breaks. They leave me and then they come back, but 4 or 5 steadily who help me out to keep the workflow going.
And how many shows are you editing?
Oof. I usually say 20. It's dropping right now. We've got a lot of seasonal breaks going on. I got a couple shows that are changing. But about 20, it's a nice steady workflow or wow. Workload, I guess you'd say.
That's a lot. That's really cool. Yeah. Okay. And you've been doing this full time for about a decade now?
Full time since 2016. So we're getting close to a decade.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
Who does that?
It's so great to be self-employed, but I guess when you were doing the financial coaching, like you were self-employed at that point too, right?
Well, that was the side hustle business.
Okay.
I was working a day job until 2015. And the financial coaching thing was just the thing I did while I was on the road. I did a lot of traveling for that day job. And when I was in a hotel room, what am I going to do? You know, watch television or sit at the bar and drink? I mean, you're by yourself most of the time that way. So I'm like, let's be productive. Here's this personal finance thing. I've got a passion for it. I can write blog posts. And then 2010, I was like, I could record podcast episodes. And so it was more of a side hustle that I did at night when I was away, and then, you know, tried to do when I was at home as well. But it wasn't a full-time gig until 2015. And even then, it just didn't really take off.
Well, you hit 2 of my vices at hotels, which is watching Food Network and drinking at the bar. Sometimes HGTV. I just drink in the room. Yeah. I mean, I don't have cable at home. So yeah, I get there, I just turn on Food Network and I could watch Guy Fieri like I don't know, 24 hours a day, which is basically what it seems to be on the Food Network these days. So,
oh, yeah. Well, you'd be totally at home here. My wife watches it all the time, too. 24 so, in 24, I think is the new show, whatever the 24-hour cooking show is. It's crazy.
Oh, yeah.
It's insane.
So I there's so many jumping off points, but I'm glad we laid out the foundation of like, you're doing about 20 shows. You have a few contractors. I did this with my business as well, where without full-time employees, it kind of lowers the responsibility. Cause it's a big weight on your shoulders. Like you have to support yourself and your family. But then if you have full-time employees, you have to think about their livelihood and their families as well. So if there's, you know, an interruption in the pipeline of like new clients, or there's a drop off or whatever issues might happen that are external outside your control, like that's a lot of stress. If you're thinking I have to create enough work or maybe like interrupt your cash flow to continue to pay them. So a lot of stress. And I like having a lean company where you could kind of scale up and scale down. No direct question there, but is that intentional? Is that part of the reason why you have a small lean company?
Yes, absolutely. I don't want to get too big. I don't want to become a big old agency with hundreds. I do have a friend who has over 150 podcasts that his company edits for, and he's got like project managers. He even built his own CRM type of thing. It's crazy. I guess I just am not driven to do that. I kind of like working for my friends, we'll say. Most of the people that have hired me, I've met at some point. They're in that FinCon economy type of community, all the personal finance genres type things. But yeah, the contractors make it so convenient to take on new clients when I can or want to. And if then I've got clients that drop off, take seasonal breaks or something, then nobody's being harmed. Of course, my contractors want steady work. They'd love to have more work if they can, but then they take vacations and then, you know, so it's an ebb and flow of the workload that happens all the time. But with having contractors instead of employees, it does make it a lot easier to manage that workflow, although the cash flow still fluctuates.
Got it. Okay. Back to the beginning. Why did you have an interest in financial literacy? Was there some driver on that?
Let's see if I can boil it down. So I was traveling a lot for the day job. I was driving through Southern Illinois to the next location I had to go and audit. And I bumped into, this is before CD players were in company cars. This is before MP3 players. This is before all that. And so I'm just flipping stations on the radio and I bump into Dave Ramsey, who reminded me of Bruce Williams. And if anybody's old who's watching or listening to this, they might know who Bruce Williams was, but he was a fantastic, like late night radio call-in advice show. Fantastic. So I was like, listen to this guy. I was like, well, this is interesting. They're talking about money. I'm good with money. Why not listen to this a little bit? But he kept yelling at his audience, you know, telling the callers, hey, you know, cut up your credit cards. You got to pay off your mortgage. You know, all the advice that is contrary to everything that I've been taught. So I was like, oh, this guy's crazy. You know, he's a shock jock, all that stuff. But then I started looking at it and I was like, you know what? This guy is right. So me and my wife, we thought we were doing good with money. I realized we weren't doing great with money. We're just average. We're average Americans. We're average. We had credit cards. We are average. We had car payments. We were average. I was like, we should be better than this. So I went all in, cut up the credit cards. We paid off all our consumer debt. We were done by 2007, just had the mortgage left, started saving for retirement, saving for our daughter's college, all that stuff. And I was like, this is good stuff. Why isn't everybody else talking about this? Why is it only Dave Ramsey I'm hearing about? And, you know, then I heard, you know, there's a couple other people out there like Clark Howard and Susie Orman, but they also had different views on money. I wanted to share my brand of money advice and just share it with the world. And that's where it got me into the blogging and the podcasting and offering financial coaching as well.
Got it. And it's cool that you hit the switch and you were like, you know what? Like we can do better. I never got into Dave Ramsey, and you know what? A lot of the big personalities, they're abrasive, except for not Clark Howard. I grew up in the Atlanta area, loved AM radio too. And,
Nicest guy in the world.
Yeah. And Clark's so nice. And, you know, we have a mutual friend, Joel Larsgaard, who worked with Clark for many years as a producer, I think, right? Like at WSB. So it's a small world. It's kind of crazy because Clark was on the TV news growing up, so he was like always a fixture. Anyway, Clark's a nice guy. Some of the others are abrasive, and like Dave Ramsey, you know, in our sort of social media world, like when I see his clips pop up, I'm just like, ah. does he really think that? Like, he's obviously a smart guy. Like, what is he selling? Like, why is he so abrasive? Is it just to get clicks? And unfortunately, it's probably like the click thing. And, you know, to get attention, you have to be a little abrasive.
But then you're saying he wanted to get clicks before clicks were a thing.
That's true. Well,
yeah.
So, but he's a gateway. So to the whole point is like, he is a great gateway for people to like get things under control and moving in the right direction. And at some point, I think probably Steve, you could fill in this portion, but like you do what you need to, as far as like what Dave is teaching. And then you're like, okay, what's next? I think there's a little bit more. Did you hit that point? And you're like, okay, what's next? And that's how you got into the deeper personal finance space and blogging and all that.
Yes and no. I mean, he covers almost all the bases. Once you get to the final step of his baby steps, then you're like, what is there more to it? You could just live on the baby steps. But there's a lot of people who just want to do more. They want to get more deeply into, what should I be investing in? You know, should I be doing more of a ETF type thing? Or, you know, should I get into real estate investing? He does talk about that, but not as heavily on what most people look at, which is the radio show and the television station or the YouTube videos. And that there's no one way of personal finance for anybody. There really is not, because you've got some people who are driven and they can create a business of their own. And there's some people who just want to make a living and support their family and then enjoy life in the margins around that work. There's no one wrong answer there. Finding the one right answer for you is the challenge, of course. And that was I was all in. I was like, I don't need credit cards. I cut them up. People think I'm crazy because I've been living without credit cards since 2008. I haven't had a true credit score since 2017. Yet I qualified for a mortgage under a self-employed income. Weird, odd person over here on this side of the camera. It's my flavor and it works for me. It works for my family. It doesn't mean that it's going to work for everybody. And of course, some people just don't want to have to deal with the troubles of, I say troubles, is not really hard living on cash and cash equivalents. They want to live their lives the way that they're used to, the way that they want to.
Very good. Okay. So you started blogging and then you started a podcast in, was it 2010? Did I catch that right?
Yeah.
So very early days. And how'd that go? I mean, like at that point, a lot of people had not heard of podcasts. I mean, for a lot of people, the gateway was like, say, 2013, mm-hmm. 2014 with the podcast Serial, which was like true crime. I listened to homebrewing podcasts starting in like 2007. So I was pretty early and it was like, you know, the dark ages. Usually it was people that had broadcasting experience. So what were those early days like in 2010?
Yeah. As far as for me doing a podcast, it was more of a passion. I knew it wasn't going to grow big, but I knew it was going to get a niche audience. And that niche audience was people who, there's two niches there, people who knew what a podcast was and were listening to them and that were interested in personal finance, money type topics. I mean, you're talking about drilling down to just a very small audience. So, you know, the downloads weren't huge. They're growing consistently over the years, but it never hit any kind of a big time monumental, no Joe Rogan here, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. It was hard because people didn't know what a podcast was. They didn't understand, because I don't think Netflix was really a household name at the time. Mm-hmm. But when you think about podcasts, it's on-demand audio or video now. People understand that with Netflix. Oh, I go to the television, scroll through the list. I hit the button on the thing I want to watch. You do that with podcasts. You just need a podcast app for it. And you were talking about how it started to take off in 2014 with Serial. Interestingly enough, it was kind of like the perfect storm, because it wasn't necessarily Serial that made everything popular. It was the fact that Serial was mostly an American consumed show. Mostly Americans would want to listen to that. And it was like within a month after Apple made the podcast app native on their phones. So the podcast app was now coming out with all the phones automatically. So people were like, oh, what's this purple button? And you know, they open it up and of course it's going to show you what's hot now. What's hot now is serial. And so they're, oh, let's try this out. Oh, true crime. That's really interesting. So it was the perfect storm of, you know, making it easier for people to find podcasts, making it, you know, visible right there on the front for what they should try. And then, oh, this true crime thing, you know, everybody's getting used to their NCIS and their CSI television shows. Oh, here I can listen to this stuff while I'm driving to work or whatever. So that's kind of the confluence of how podcasting kind of exploded while I was almost winding down my show.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
How many episodes did you run through?
200. I recorded the 200th episode. It was at FinCon. I had 10 different bloggers come up and just tell me what they learned about money while blogging about money. And that was released in October of 2015.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah, it was a nice little bow on top of everything there.
Do you happen to remember like the top number of downloads or any kind of stats from back in the day? Just curious personally.
Well, yeah, there's a couple things that I did that made it peak. You could say the episode would get an average of up to 1500 downloads in the first 30 days, which is really good. Especially but I was working on it for years. Yeah. Yeah. Now this is before IAB. IAB is an organization that kind of put parameters around, you know, measuring what a real download is, because there were a lot of bots out there, meaning things hit your website, they hit the play button, it plays it for a second, or I don't even know how the bots work. All I know is it wasn't really a listen. So how many qualified plays were there? I don't know. But I was always looking at the progression, not the total number. A couple things that I did. One was I remember interviewing Joshua Sheets from Radical Personal Finance. We were talking about, oh, here we go. We're talking about Dave Ramsey again. Mm-hmm. I forget the title, but it was something like, is Dave Ramsey dangerous to your personal finances or something like that? Or is that his advice dangerous or something like that? Great discussion. And I recorded it in the hallways, FinCon 2013, and gave him a copy. And I was working on mine. I was editing mine while he released it on his. I didn't know he released it on his show. But all of a sudden, there's this spike in downloads in my Libsyn account. I'm like, what's going on? For the whole weekend, I'm like, I can't figure out what's going on. But all of a sudden, I'm just getting tons and tons of downloads. Then I realized he had to release the show. So people were coming to my show after hearing it on his show. That was cool. Another thing. So this is all like guerrilla marketing stuff. Another thing I did was in 2014, I came up with the idea of, you hear about the promo swaps and the show swaps or people being on other people's shows. Well, I decided what I'm going to do is I'm going to be on somebody else's show as the host. So I'm going to do their show as the host, like, you know, an April Fool's Day joke. So it was April Fool's Day of 2014 that not only did I do one for Cash Car Convert, but I did one for Star of the Doubts by Jared Easley, who was a founder of Podcast Movement. And he had an interview show. He interviewed people and he'd always ask them questions. And I asked him the same questions to him on his own show. So that was fun. But then the big one was Stacking Benjamin's show. I am editing their show now, but at that time I wasn't. We were just friends in the podcast space. And so I did the Stacking Benjamin show for April 1st, 2014. In the same format that they do. And I'll tell you what, it almost killed me. It was ridiculous because you got to have a co-host there. You got to have the announcer guy. You got to have a guest. Oh, it was insane. But because I did all those three shows, I was the host for their shows for that day. It was fun, but it also got me exposure on other platforms or other shows that are kind of in line with what I did. Or would I do it? Cash Car Convert, definitely in line. Stacking Benjamin's definitely in line. And so that definitely raised the average downloads that I was getting for at least the next 3 months.
Wow. And it's all, I mean, those are the same things that work now that I'm like, oh, I need to do that more. But it's like, you know, the cross promotion with just the right audience, and you got to bring, you know, good entertainment. And for people right. that don't know, Stacking Benjamins is like, well, it's called the greatest money show on earth. That's their tagline, but it's like a variety show. Those guys are pros. They like Joe Salcihi and OG, like they work really hard on that show. So when you do the editing, so all pros all throughout.
And I get to edit the show, which again, it almost kills me every time.
And they do like three shows a week or something like that.
Three shows, at least an hour long. I get 90 to 2 hours worth of audio. And yeah, it's a lot of work. But it's also my favorite podcast. It's been my favorite podcast since before I edited it. So it was a natural fit when he came and said, hey, I need serious help here. And I was like, hey, I'm on board.
So I think that it's a good time to like transition to like the editing portion. So you had your show. It sounded like, you know, you worked on it for a few years. You were winding it down. But it sounded like you maybe already started picking up some editing clients. Talk about the transition from like that portion. And you stopped your full-time job. Like things happened pretty quick.
It all happened pretty quick. It was a little too convenient how well it worked. Because when I tell you how it really worked out, you're going to be like, it's crazy. So I had been wanting the financial coaching to be my career. And I was marketing it with the blog and the podcast. I thought, okay, I got the tools. I can do this. And I left the day job because it got to be where when I first started, it was like 25% travel. When I left, it was like 95% travel. It was ridiculous. And we had a daughter. I wanted to be home with my daughter sometimes and see her other than on the weekends. And it just got to be too much. I was like, no, I got to go. So I made the leap into the financial coaching full time. So I left the day job. It was March or May, I can't remember, of 2015. Focused solely on the financial coaching business. Had the podcast. Was attending FinCon, meeting people, encouraging people. Not trying to be a podcast editor or even helping people launch podcasts. I was a creator like them. I was wanting to learn from them, just like they were hopefully learning from me. And it wasn't until the end of 2015 where Paula Pant from A 4-Day Thing and Jay Money from Budgets Are Sexy, they had been talking all year about starting a show together. It was a great idea. They have interesting chemistry. They're complete opposites people. Paula's very organized and she uses those, you know, $20 words. And Jay Money just wants to have fun. And it's just entertaining. So you put those two together, it's a weird chemistry. But they couldn't get it going. And they're like, let's just call Steve. He's always encouraging people to start a podcast. Let's ask him some questions. So I'm like, sure, I'd love to talk to Paula Pant and Jay Money. Who wouldn't? So we get on the call. And we're talking through it all. And they're like, okay, we just want to hit record. Steve, will you do the rest? And I was like, I know how to do it. Sure. But I'm not going to be able to do it for free. I mean, it takes a lot of work. And they're like, absolutely, Steve, we'll pay you. I think I was making less than minimum wage after it was all said and done. Yeah. But we launched that show. Two big bloggers, big email lists. It was in the top five of the business charts on Apple on the first day, which is just crazy unheard of. But, yeah. You know, big email lists, of course. So I was just doing that as a side hustle. And then another show came to me and said, hey, you know, I don't want to do the editing anymore. Will you do it? So there's more people in the space who heard that I was editing for Paula and Jay. So like, maybe Steve will do it for us too. And just kept building. And I was like, okay, this is going to be a lot of work, but I love it. This isn't what I was signing up for, but I love it. I can still help the personal finance and spreading financial literacy by making these shows sound better. Obviously, the financial coaching thing was fun. I liked it, but it wasn't enough to make a career out of it. It was still stagnant. I thought I could grow it, and it didn't work. So that failure pushed me into finally saying, okay, I give up. I'm going to do this podcast editing full time, which was scary because even at that time, it wasn't a full-time income. It was about half of what my salary was at the old day job that I had left, but I didn't have a company car either. So yeah, so that was mid-2016 when I was like, that's it. I'm giving everything else up, the blog, the I mean, they're still out there, but I wasn't going to release any more episodes. And I had planned on launching another show, a new show. That's why I was retiring the old show and launching a new one. And that just never got off the ground because this confluence of luck kept happening in my life where I was able to then commit my full time into building this podcast editing business.
Interesting. That's so cool. And the thing is, like, you started going to FinCon and like, when was the first one? 2011, something like that?
No, I missed the first one. I could only go to the 2012. That was 2012. The first one. I've been to every single one since.
Okay. When it's like the timing worked out great with like what you were trying to do. And like the thing is like, I know how fun those conferences are, but also the networking and the relationship building. So it's like you were laying the foundation for at least the three previous years going to FinCon, but also like blogging and the other outreach. And like you make friends online because you're consuming, you know, their blogs and you comment back and forth. It was a different time, like whatever, 15 yeah. years ago when all that was going on.
When it was fun.
Yeah. And now, I mean, people still read blogs, but like things are so different now. Okay. So that worked out really well. Let's talk about pricing, and people can go to your site and get like specific details and stuff. And that's over at stevestewart.me.
Yes.
But yeah, let's talk about pricing in the early days and what you've arrived at now. And feel free to mention the exact prices, which could subject to change, you know, if people see this in the future or whatever.
Right, right. Well, I'm actually doing an experiment now, so I'll get to that.
Okay.
So when I started, I was doing the J Money and Paula Pant. It was Money was the name of the show, Money Show. It eventually got rebranded to Afford Anything after J Money left about a year. Well, it's 26 episodes in, not a year later, but 6 months later. Back then, I was charging like $40 an episode. And if you do inflation adjusted, it's still like $40 an episode. I mean, it's ridiculously low. Yeah. It's nothing. And it took me about 3 years of building, not just, you know, building enough work into my life where I could do this full time, but raising my rates along the way. And there's always that internal conflict of, am I really worth all that money? Should I raise it a little bit? Would they say no? Will I lose clients if I raise my rates? But yeah, I was raising rates up to, you know, a good $125 to $150 an episode. And that's all based on time. There's different ways to charge for services. It could be a flat rate. It could be a monthly retainer. There's all kinds of different ways, but I was basing it on, you give me this number of minutes and it's going to be this amount. And if we go over that, then there's an upcharge. And now we're at about $345 for a full 45-minute recording. That's audio only. So you can see the difference there, $40 to like $350. It's a huge gain. But I've also, if you heard the episodes I was editing back in the day, even on my own show, they weren't great. I mean, I was able to edit, but not like now. Obviously, I've got my 10,000 hours in. Obviously, I've learned some new things. I've got some better tools. AI is here to help with a lot of the really crappy audio. Oh my gosh, sometimes I have to give up and it's just like, throw it into this AI tool. Okay, that's pretty good. I'm going to have to use that. There's a lot of reasons why prices have increased over time. And I don't know where we're going with this piece of the discussion. What is it that you want your audience to know about my pricing? I mean, I'm not trying to sell my services or anything.
No. This is perfect. Yeah, just, I mean, you had to come up with some amount, and it's hard because you don't know. So you pick something and you move forward and you adjust it. And like, that's the reality. Like, you kind of have to find the market price and what works for you. So you've tested it out, and yeah, you know, you can keep going. So yeah, you have like sort of a base amount. Video is big now. Like, how do you deal with that?
I don't want to do high end video editing because I just don't have the time to learn how to do it really well. I do have a team member who does excellent video editing, but then of course the rate's going to be, it's ridiculous. I wouldn't pay those amounts for my services. But what I do is I do have an offer called Video Light. And if we want to go into this, we could talk about video podcasting. For the most part, people are not video podcasting. They're recording video and they're putting it on YouTube, but they're not video podcasting. They're taking the audio, they're putting it into the traditional podcast apps. Spotify, Apple, iHeart, Amazon Music, Overcast, Pocket Cast, all that stuff. But it's not a true video podcast because it's not video there. It's video on YouTube because video, YouTube owns video. You say video, everybody thinks YouTube immediately. No question. They just, YouTube, oh, I can find it on YouTube because everything is there. There's no barrier to entry, almost no barrier to entry. It comes already on all the things. So you get a phone, the app's there. You get a smart TV, it's already there. It's on your computer. You have a browser. You can get there in no time. So it makes sense for video to be there. But I don't want to do the high-end Mr. Beast type of video production because it takes a lot of time, a lot of energy, which means it costs a lot of money. And my clients don't want to have to wait also for the time that it takes to do all that. We're trying to get episodes out once a week on average, something like that. So I do what's called a Video Light package. And that's going to give them what's better than just people who puke up their Zoom recordings onto YouTube. It's going to give them, you know, some music in there if they have music and they want to do a quick intro. It's going to give them lower thirds, going to give them some overlays. We're going to take out the big rocks. The big rocks meaning it, you know, if the Amazon guy delivers a package at the front door and the dog is going crazy and they stop recording for a minute, we're going to take that out. We're not going to leave it in. So they're going to get a better product than what they would normally do if they were to edit it themselves.
Yeah, we leave it all. Yeah.
This is real life, folks. Everything but live. We take out the big rocks, we make it look better, make it sound better, obviously. So that it's going to be they're going to have a nice presence on YouTube, and it's not going to be, I'll say, disrespectful to their brand. You don't want to come out and misrepresent your brand by having just this long, boring chit-chat show when it could be a little bit better, a little more exciting. And we're not going to talk about the YouTube algorithm and why that's important, but then they're going to have their expertly produced audio episode, and then they're going to have that video for YouTube to give them that exposure. Because YouTube is really, for a podcaster, it's more like a social platform. It's marketing for them.
Mm-hmm. You have the discoverability where, you know,
absolutely,
on the podcast side, it's much tougher. People kind of have to intentionally, they're like, I'm bored. Like, can I find something else? And, you know, there's some suggested similar shows based, I think the algorithm is based on like other common listeners. Like if someone listens to my show and a couple similars, then other people that find that interesting, similar to Netflix, absolutely, you know, that kind of thing. They know, yeah, kind of what you like. So yeah, super interesting. With the video stuff, it does get complicated. And side story, I was interviewing Joe Saul Sehy for my other show, Leaf Blower. Shows up, and it was like, it may be here for a while. So we talked about it a second. We pushed through, and we actually left it in because it's just like my show.
It's part of the story now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like, you have to leave it. Yeah.
Can we do this? And then it's like, I think it's okay. And then it's like, it's like, okay. But we talked about it, so it's a thing in the show, and it fits the brand. So it's a little tough. One thing you mentioned in the pre-interview was profit first. And I think it comes into play 100% for pricing. So can you give us a little overview on that?
Yeah. Profit First is a book and a method that was written by Mike Michalowicz back in around 2016. I really didn't get into it until a couple of years ago. Now I'm a money nerd. So I love all the things. I love the budgeting. I love balancing my checkbook. I love all those things. But when I learned about Profit First, I was like, oh, this is really good for small businesses. And it works for big businesses too. But this is a way where I can organize my finances in my business side and not have to think about it. It's taking less time for me to do all that money stuff, which I enjoy doing, but it's saying, hey, just put this aside, let it run, and let me explain what I mean. So in Profit First, there's four primary categories. Well, in any business, you think about it, there's four primary categories. You've got your expenses, obviously, right? You've got your taxes, income taxes, things like that. You've got payroll. So you got to pay yourself, obviously. And then you've got your profit. Now, payroll and profit are two different things because you can set yourself up for a regular draw. Hey, I'll take out $1,000 every week or something like that. But with Profit First, it's incentivizing you to, in the personal finance space, we say, you know, save for retirement. So, you know, put money aside for yourself, pay yourself first, right? This is kind of the same for small business. You're paying yourself first by saying, I'm going to take just this percentage of whatever comes into the business and put it aside for a little while and call that profit. So it forces you to look at all the other things then. Because now if you're used to running like in the old days, you'd look at your income minus expenses and what's left over is profit. Instead, now you're looking at your income minus your profit equals the expenses, the operating costs, the taxes, all that stuff. And it's forcing you to look at those and make adjustments. A lot of people don't look at the expenses as closely as they should. And you only look at your books twice a week or twice a month. You don't have to go in and look at your books more than that. Because you set up, so I have a bank account with this company called Novo. There's also one called Relay. That one's actually, Relay is actually associated with Mike Michalowicz, where you're opening up a business bank account. It's a free business bank account, which is great. You need to separate your personal from your business. So your business bank account is over here. And you say, all the money that comes into my business goes into this account. But these two types of business accounts, Novo or Relay, you can set it up so that a certain percentage goes into a bucket. So one bucket would be operation costs. Another bucket would be that profit bucket. Another one would be taxes. And you can do a simple calculation on what you had been doing to figure out what those percentages should be, and then just start running from there and tweaking along the way. I was like, well, that's kind of cool. I know I'm going to be taking 20% out for taxes, and it's going to go into this bucket sitting over here. Great. Automatic. $1,000 comes in, $200 goes right there. Let's say I'm paying myself 50% payroll, 50% of that, $500 is going to go over to this bucket over here. And so when I go in to do my books twice a month, it's all done for me. I already know. I have all this money set aside for operating expenses. I have all this money set aside for taxes. I'm going to throw that into a high interest savings account. I can take this money home, transfer it to my personal account. It's already done for me. I don't have to do anything. Now, there's still accounting and stuff that you'll want to do a little deeper than that, because obviously you want to look at your expenses and see, is there a recurring subscription that you no longer need? I've got a ton of those. You know, I was, you know, subscribed to this service, and then this service over here started doing something similar, and I didn't need the first one anymore because AI and all that stuff. So it really took a lot of the weight out of having to look at my books for my business, and I could spend all more of that time talking to people, you know, making sales, editing podcasts. It was really a great organizational scheme for cash flow in my business. And it kept me from having to think about debt. I mean, you think about it, you're putting money you're getting in and you're putting it aside to be spent. And you could have those expenses automatically deducted from that business account. So like there's a tool I use called Descript. Mm-hmm. Every year, a couple $100 comes out because I'm using Descript. It's already there. I don't have to look at it. Expenses paid out, done. It's just great. There's a lot less work that has to be done. It's kind of automated.
Very good. And it keeps you much deeper topic people could spend. Well, there's a whole book and much more about this, but you know, one of the biggest issues, people will screw up their cash flow, especially with taxes. And then, you know, especially if someone grows fast and they're like, oh, I'm all of a sudden making $25,000 a month and they're spending a lot. Well, yeah, you may have to pay about 30% of that for taxes, depending like how much money you make and the state that you're in and a few other factors. So it could be pretty devastating if you accidentally spent all of that. But you had the personal finance background, so you weren't gonna blow it. But yeah, taxes can mess you up, or cash flow if you don't realize, like, hey, you have a big expense coming up, or if maybe some of your vendors are paying you a little like 30 days later, or, you know, there's some other factors that come in and it could screw up your cash flow if you are not managing it that way.
So, yeah, cash flow is the number one killer of small business.
It's the insane.
Biggest hurdle and the number one killer, and especially when it comes to income taxes. You don't have enough money to pay the income taxes.
Yeah. Okay. So this is great. Thanks for going in pretty deep on the pricing. I know we only have a few minutes left. I have two main questions, and then we'll make sure people know where they could find you. And actually, I want to make sure, like, you have a very, it's a great thing for people to take like the next step if they're interested in editing as well. You actually have a podcast editing academy. So we'll talk about that, but I want to make sure people hear it and they're thinking about it. So any big challenges or mistakes? So timing was good. You figured out some pricing. Did you have any big blunders along the way?
Gosh, I should be ready for this question because everybody always asks that.
Well, we can come back to it. I can give you a second. We can come back to it, and maybe not. I mean, sometimes, you know, you're.
Well, I don't want it to sound like I want it to sound like this has all been easy. It's self-employment. Of course, it's not easy. Yeah. Well, let's stick with the taxes, because that first full year that I was employed, I was like, okay, I got to make sure I'm good on these taxes. I actually talked to somebody. I said, here's what I got. It's August of 2017. This is my first full year. Does it look like I'll be within $1,000 or $2,000 on my income taxes? And like, sure. I don't know what happened. I've been trying to do the CSI on it ever since, but somehow my taxes that were unpaid, meaning I hadn't put enough aside to pay my taxes, were like $6,000. I'm like, how could I be that far off? It was ridiculous. Of course, around that time, there were some tax rules changing and stuff like that, but that was a huge problem. Cause I mean, a couple $1,000s, okay, we can adjust things. We can cut back on things for a little bit, you know, tighten our belts if we have to. I can maybe make some more money, send less to the contractors, do it all myself. You know, whatever I can to make that, you know, extra $2,000-$3,000, but $6,000. Yeah. The income taxes is really, that's just the bit. I thought I was ready. I was
right.
I was all convinced. I was like, okay, I'm gonna be pretty good for this first year. No, totally screwed up. And then next year I got like a $4,000 tax refund. I'm like, what is going on?
Now, and do you have an S corp, or is it filed as an S corp, or is it straight proprietor?
It's straight for LLC, sole proprietor. Yeah.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
And none of this is tax advice, by the way. So.
Yeah. As I say, after all of those confusing things, I'm like, I'm going to work with somebody for a bit. So I did hire an accountant for a couple of years and got things. I still don't know how it all happened, but maybe a big lesson here is don't be afraid when you're going self-employed to hire out some help. Hire out for some help, whether it's a contractor doing the work for you in your business or somebody who's going to do those things that you don't want to do in your business, like bookkeeping or like the marketing or heck, even managing social media or doing the website. If you're not expert there, but you want to, you know, master those things, don't try to learn how to do it yourself. That's why I'm not getting into video editing. I don't want to learn how to edit video masterfully like that. Not yet. It'd be fun, but I love what I'm doing over here. I want to focus on that. But hiring out that help is really important.
Very good. Okay. So tell us a little bit about the Podcast Editor Academy, like who's it for, a few details. And then I have a couple of like fun questions for me. I don't know if other people will find it fun, but yeah, what's sure. up with the Academy?
Yeah. Well, I started a Facebook group in 2017 called the Podcast Editor Club because there were no other groups in Facebook or anywhere I could find that was talking about the post-production side of podcasting. They're all talking about, you know, what mic to use or what media host or how do you get guests or whatever. How do you grow an audience? I didn't want to talk about this. I already knew about those things. I wanted to find more about this side of podcasting that didn't exist. So I started a Facebook group and it started growing. I was like, well, this is cool. And then a friend of mine became a business partner. His name's Mark Deal. He was always turning these little dials in the podcasting space. And he just turned out to be a good friend. And he's like, you know what? You should start an academy. I'm like, really? Am I good enough to do something like that? There's a lot of people who are more qualified to advise people on editing than I am, but I think I've got enough of the school of hard knocks behind me to be able to put this together. So we started the Academy in the year 2000, right after the COVID shutdown. And it's to help people who want to do what I do, be podcast editors or managers or producers, or just be on that service side of podcasting, learn how to do it as a business. So it's not just like earlier you said, Podcast Editing Academy. No, it's not about editing as much as it is about the editor. Podcast Editor Academy is about the person, about helping them to grow a business. And yes, of course, there's training and tutorials in there for them to learn how to do things, but it's also about marketing. And I'm able to help them find jobs from people come to me that aren't the right fit. I'm going to offer that to people in my academy because we know that these people are serious about what they're doing. They want to make it a career, so they're not going to just be that person who's on Upwork doing, you know, the occasional gig or two. These are the people who are serious about it. So I've been growing that thing since, me and Mark have been growing it since 2000. And it's hard work. It's not a whole lot of fun. But when you look back at everything that's been built there, it's like, wow, this is pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was going to say, like, I didn't realize some of the people that have gone through the Academy. I'm like, oh yeah, I know that person. Like I know the shows are doing that sort of thing. Yeah. So yeah, highly recommend. No better person to learn from, I would say. So we'll put a link so people can check it out if they're interested in learning how to become an editor and go through the tutorials and all that stuff. So
great. Thank you.
And okay. A couple quick, fun questions. So you mentioned a script. I'm curious about like software and like some of your gear, like what mic are you using? So you could just kind of lay out like a quick quick thing. I'm just curious, you know?
Sure. Well, my main DAW, digital audio workstation, audio editing program, is still Audacity. They actually just celebrated their 25th birthday the other day. I've been using it for almost as long. I was using it before podcasting existed. So I just got to know it and I've just been able to master it. And I'm so quick and easy with it now. It's like, you don't have to think about it. But there are other tools that I use for the post-production side that Audacity isn't as good at. There's a tool called Isotope RX. I remember the first time I heard about it, it was in my Facebook group, Podcast Editors Club. And somebody said, why am I just now hearing about Isotope RX? It's sorcery. So what you do is you bring your audio in and there's a bunch of different tools you can use, but it just sweetens the audio and it's amazing. Now AI does a lot of this stuff automatically, but this was back then. But then when it comes to video or making clips and stuff like that, or even just editing in a different way, the script, it reinvented the way to edit. So people who are watching or listening to this, envision that you have a recording, whether it's audio or video, and you just drag it into this app on your desktop called the script. It's going to create a transcript. And everybody's like, oh, so what? Big deal, right? Well, you edit the transcript and it edits the audio and or video. Now, it's not perfect. It's going to cut some things a little too sharply or whatever. It's not as going to be as good or detailed as I would be with Audacity. But when I'm looking at the big chunks, rearranging things, selecting items, I think, ooh, this would be a good video short for YouTube. You put captions on. It's just amazing, an amazing tool. So those are probably the three biggest tools that I use as far as the audio or video post-production side.
Got it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Descript. It was pretty good at first, but now it's gotten much better. And I think I moved to it completely in my couple VAs, you know, it's been over a couple years, but yeah, the fact that you could edit the transcript is huge, huge time saver. Like you said, it's not perfect, but, a lot of this stuff, like, if we have to stop and think, it's just, you could be silent for a minute and then it'll just take out, you know, all of that, make it half a second. So you don't have to struggle with it. Okay. And then what kind of mic you use there?
Oh, I have the Heil PR40.
Okay.
What's interesting is I didn't want this mic. I was like, this is way back in the day. This was the microphone everybody was talking about, the Heil PR40. I was like, well, everybody's talking about the Heil. I don't want the Heil. But I went to a conference and they had like 8 mics lined up. And they're like, here, test yourself on each one of these. We're going to give you the headphones. And so I was going up the line. Oh, here's the Behringer, whatever. It's like a $20 mic. Oh, here's the ATR2100. This is the one I've got. Great. I kept going up the line like, okay, this one looks good. This one sounds okay. This one sounds a little flat. This one's way too bassy. And then I got the Heil. I'm like, okay, well, I won't like the Heil. And I went, all right, so this is testing the Heil. Ooh, hello, baby. And I just fell in love with it. Yeah. So I had to have one, and it's been fantastic ever since. There's a lot of other good mics out there, but this is a professional mic, meaning it's not one you just plug into your computer. You need an interface to go between the two. It doesn't have a USB cable, is what I'm trying to say.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
In fact, I think you've got the Shure. Are you on the Shure MV7 or the SM7B?
It is MV7. Yeah. Yeah. Good eyes. So it does have the USB. I do have a small interface. It's a pretty old, like, I forget the name of the brand.
M Audio. Scarlett. Oh, okay.
It's like an M Audio that I use
M-Audio. For
like guitar, something or other. I think great it might be like 15 years old, but yeah. Occasionally I will plug this in via XLR, but then you have to use the preamp and blah, blah, blah. And right. I have 3 of these. I was like, they're good enough. And I haven't done a test, but these are good mics. They're supposed to be the same as the MB or this, what is
the SM7B.
SM7B.
Yeah. Although it is a little bit better, but the MV7 is the USB version, which is, it's 95% the same.
Pretty close. Yeah. So it's really good. I have a couple of those back there for when I have people in the studio, we'll sit back there. So,
yeah.
Okay. Very good. Well, Steve, this has been amazing. People should check out the Academy. Where else could people find you out there?
Home base is stevestewart.me. That's S-T-E-W-A-R-T. .me, because the guy who owns stevestewart.com has owned it since 1997. I'm not getting it anytime soon.
All right. Well, we'll link up to all that stuff. And thanks again. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Doug. I appreciate being on. This has been an honor.